TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The End of Water as We Know It, with Argonne National Lab scientist Dr. Seth Darling. Through the huge computing power of the Argonne Lab and advances in science that give us an inventory of global water supply and use, a picture of water emerges that is of great concern. Even though water is most vital for survival, the status of depletion or contamination is not well known to the public, and there are very few mechanisms in place worldwide for water protection and access to water as a human right. In this May 18, 2016 talk, valuable information is introduced to support and inspire local efforts. Dr. Darling updates statistics about the water embedded in certain products. He also makes an interesting connection between energy production and water and surprises us with research that shows how the energy industry withdraws 200 billion gallons of water per day in the U.S. alone. Seth Darling is a scientist at Argonne National Lab and a fellow at the Institute for Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. He's the co-author with Douglas Sisterson of the 2014 book, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate. He spoke at the International House, University of Chicago. Here's Dr. Seth Darling.
I'm going to talk to you about water, and I promise it will not take over an hour. So we are deeply connected to water in so many different ways. You could even say our spirit is entwined with water. Who can't see a calm lake and feel a deep sense of serenity? Or wonder in the majesty of a great waterfall, feel refreshed with a dip in the pool on a hot day, or understand the terror of something like a tsunami? Water is diverse, powerful, and essential. You can't have great coffee without great water. I'll let these famous explorers tell you another important thing about water.
The universal translator is coming online, sir.
Okay.
Bags of mostly water. An accurate description of humans, sir.
This is true. We are mostly water. So when we're talking about water, we're talking about us. Many of our great landscapes were carved by water. The Great Lakes were carved out by the retreating glaciers at the end of the last ice age. Water has, in fact, dictated the rise and fall of many of the great civilizations in our history. A few examples here. The ancient pharaohs derived a lot of their power because of their knowledge and ability to manipulate, in some ways, the flooding of the Nile River that deposited silt on the agricultural lands there and produced all of the grain, which kept that civilization going. The ancient Romans were some of the great water engineers of history. You're probably familiar with the aqueducts, but they also invented water mills, water mining, and in fact, they did something with water that we got away from, and we're just starting to get back to this idea today of using different streams of water for different purposes. So they had different water going into their fountains than they had going into their bathhouses. This was a great idea, which we don't do anymore, and it's an important one that we will, as I said, be getting back to. The ancient Chinese, it was the Grand Canal connecting the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers in the north and south of China that allowed them to move grain between those two river systems and keep their armies unified and brought together that empire. So one of the lessons we can learn from history is that civilizations that rely too long on old water technology are routinely overtaken by those that innovate to take advantage of water's opportunities and challenges. This is a lesson that we should learn. Another important point from history, historians will tell you that Europe's lack of a major inland water system, there's no Yangtze or Ganges or Tigris and Euphrates in Europe, led to the rise of independent, small independent nations and ultimately the rise of liberal democracy. So in a sense, you can attribute democracy to water. Water has also driven a number of revolutions. It was transoceanic sailing that globalized civilization. Water wheels launched the Industrial Revolution. Watt's steam engine revolutionized transportation and industry. Sanitation of our water system extended human lifetimes by decades. Great dams like Hoover Dam finally gave mankind control over the fickle precipitation of Mother Nature, limiting both flooding and droughts. That allowed food production to increase, while at the same time giving you hydroelectric electricity. That is one of the reasons that the United States rose as a global power. And intermodal shipping containers have revolutionized global commerce. About 90% of commerce occurs on the water in our oceans. Water also controls our weather. So water comes into our lives in so many central ways. Let me ask you a question to test your knowledge on water here. So we use a lot of water in this country. Who do you think is the largest withdrawer? Where does most of our water get withdrawn in this country? Anybody? Agriculture was what I was expecting you to say. That's where most of our water is used, but I chose my words carefully here. I said withdrawn. Power plants. Power plants in our country withdraw over 200 billion gallons of water a day. And that's used in part to boil that water by burning coal or natural gas or nuclear heat or whatever to make steam, to turn turbines and make electricity, but also for cooling of those power plants. And so they return a lot of that water back to the lake or river that it came from, so it's not used in the sense that it is in agriculture, but they do withdraw much more than we do for agriculture. So that's one intimate connection between water and energy, that we use so much water to make the energy that we all use. But you can flip that around, too, and say, where does most of our energy go? Well, it turns out that the biggest user of our electricity is actually water treatment, distribution, and use. So it goes both ways. Energy and water are so interconnected that there's a name for it. It's called the water-energy nexus. And Argonne National Laboratory is a Department of Energy laboratory, so you might ask, why are we talking about water? Here's a big reason why we're talking about water, because water and energy are inextricable. Okay. So water's clearly important, but it's invisible. Water is actually hidden all around us, even in this room. Let me give you an example. If you take 683 gallons of water, you can grow 6 pounds of alfalfa hay. If you take those 6 pounds of alfalfa hay and you feed them into a machine that looks like that, it will give you 1 gallon of milk. So in that single gallon of milk sitting in your fridge are represented almost 700 gallons of water. It's not just milk. It's all of the food that we use. A single grape, not a bunch of grapes, one grape, is about a third of a gallon of water. One walnut, almost 5 gallons. One potato, nearly 7. A cup of coffee. And this isn't a venti latte frappuccino. We're talking about just a cup of coffee with nothing in it, is 37 gallons. If you do make it a latte, it's going to go way up because, as I explained a moment ago, dairy has a lot of embedded water in it. A single Greek yogurt is about 90 gallons. And the biggest culprit here would be meat, especially beef, which represents, in the case of a hamburger, over 600 gallons of water. But it's not just food. It's also the materials that we use. Steel. To make steel, you need water. To make 1 pound of steel, which is not a very big piece of steel, it would take 11 gallons of water. And this is true of all the other materials that we use. Plastic, cement, cotton, paper, all of them take water to make. What that means is that the clothes that you're all wearing, the phone that's in your pocket, the car that you drove to get here, all of those things have within them virtual water. So globally, we don't move water from one part of the world to another in any appreciable amount because the scales of water that we use are ginormous. To give you an example of that, the Jardine Water Plant here outside of Chicago processes as much water in one day as the entire volume of petroleum we use in the United States in that day. So you're not going to move that type of volume from one point to another, and I'll talk more about that later. But we do move virtual water around because all of the goods that we're shipping around the earth have within them, as I just described, embedded water. And so there are folks who have looked at this and kind of tracked. There are countries that are net exporters of virtual water and countries that are net importers of virtual water. And perhaps it's not surprising when you see, for example, North Africa and the Middle East are net importers of virtual water. They're not bringing in water, but they're bringing in an awful lot of food, for example. So we're moving a lot of water around, not all of which is sustainable water, and we're not policing this in any organized way. This is a policy problem that is going to have to be addressed going forward. Let me just give you one example. There's a company based in Saudi Arabia called Al Marai, but I'm told that means the pasture. There's no pasture in Saudi Arabia. The pasture in this case is in the American Southwest. So Al Marai is the largest vertically integrated dairy company in the world. And what they do is they extract groundwater in the Southwest. We'll get to groundwater a little bit later. And they use that to grow hay. And then they ship that hay to the dairy cows in the Mideast to make the dairy to use there. So they're actually moving massive amounts of groundwater, effectively, from the American Southwest, which is, as I'll describe, not sustainable, to another part of the world. These are things that we need to start paying much more attention to. So water is important, but in fact, it's becoming even more important as we go forward in time. So we don't have a shortage of water on Earth. There's an enormous amount of water on Earth, but unfortunately, the vast majority of it is in the oceans, salt water, which we can't use for much of anything in that form. So it's actually about 97% of the water on Earth is in our oceans. But you can't drink that stuff. You can't water your crops with it. You can't even put it through a power plant, in fact. The water that we all deal with is the fresh water, which represents less than 3% of the water on Earth. So how is this fresh water distributed, this less than 3% of the water? Well, there's the water that we see that, you know, evaporates, ends up in the clouds, comes down as rain and snow, and we see that in forms like Lake Michigan out there. That I would call renewable runoff. Some of that water is going to percolate down through the ground and form groundwater, aquifers. And as long as you withdraw that water at a slower pace than it's being replenished, it would be renewable. Of course, that's not what we're doing, though. In almost every case, when we start tapping these aquifers, we're withdrawing the water at a much faster rate than it's being replenished. And so in that sense, it's not truly renewable. There are other aquifers in the ground that are sometimes called fossil water, akin to fossil fuels. And it's not fossil in the sense like fossil fuels where it's made of fossilized organisms, but in the sense that it's been there for a really, really long time and is not being replenished at all. In some cases, hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions of years, some of these aquifers, when you tap those, that is a one-time use resource. An example of that, Libya. Libya built something called the Great Man-Made River, where they ran under the Sahara to bring fossil water for them to use for all the things we use water for. And they spent $32 billion U.S. dollars building that Great Man-Made River, and the projections are that it will only last about 20 years. At that point, they've expended that resource. So how is this less than 3% of water distributed? Well, all that stuff we see is only actually about 0.3% of the less than 3% of the water on Earth. About 30% of that less than 3% is in that groundwater. And I'm assuming you guys can do the math and see that that doesn't total up to 100. Where is the rest of that fresh water? It's locked up in places where we can't get at it, things like glaciers and the permafrost and so on. So the amount of water we're talking about that we all use is actually a tiny fraction of that massive amount of water on Earth. What's worse is that that resource is becoming even smaller. One of the reasons is because of climate change. One of the effects of climate change is that glaciers are melting. All over the planet, glaciers are melting. That's been very well documented now. The reason that's a big concern is that glaciers like those in the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas, the annual melt from those glaciers is the source of most of the major river systems in Asia. So the Indus and the Ganges and the Yangtze and the Yellow, all those rivers, that's where they get their water from. So when those glaciers disappear, those rivers are going to dry up. And that water is the source of water for about 1.5 billion people on Earth and growing. So where are all those people going to get water when those glaciers are gone or when they've shrunk enough that there's not enough water there? I don't have an answer for you. There's another issue with climate disruption, which is that we're getting more severe droughts than we've ever witnessed before. So this is well known to folks who live in California now and all of us who buy the produce that is grown there. But other parts of the world, too. The drought that's in the Middle East is said to be the worst in 900 years. And people will tell you that that drought led to food shortages, which has led to a lot of the civil unrest that's in that part of the world right now. What's going on in Syria was in part fed by food shortages, leading to refugee crises and everything else. So we've got a serious supply problem with water. It's a tiny supply, and it's shrinking. What about demand? Well, bad news there, too. Turns out demand is skyrocketing for water because of population growth and development. We just start using more water. Because remember, it's not just bathing and brushing your teeth and whatever. Anything you use, remember, has water in it. So as people start to have more things, that means they need more water. So it's projected that over the next 35 years, by the year 2050, global demand will rise at least 55%. So we've got shrinking supply, growing demand for a resource that we depend on for almost everything in our life. So what does that mean? It means that just like in the previous century where oil conflicts governed our geopolitics, in this century it's going to be water. We are going to have water-based conflicts, which are going to shape our century. And this is already happening. The Aral Sea is all but dried up in Central Asia, so the Fergana Valley is no longer fertile in the way it once was, and all of those Central Asian countries are sniping with each other now about those limited resources that are left. Same is going on in intrastate conflict in India. Another example from South America, the Salala River that flows from Bolivia into Chile. It goes into the Atacama Desert there, one of the driest places on Earth, and they need it for their mining operations in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the foundations of the Chilean economy. They want those water resources, but the Bolivians need them too, and if the Bolivians take more of that water, less of it gets to Chile, and so there's conflict between them now. The Nile Basin has been a source of water-based conflict since, as I told you, the time of the pharaohs, but this is still true today. You have countries on the tail end of the Nile, like Egypt, that rely on the Nile, but those headwaters are in Ethiopia and Kenya. And so that continues to be a source of struggle. And we all are familiar with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A lot of folks don't realize, though, that a big piece of that conflict revolves around the limited water resources in that region. Those draft agreements that get written up once in a while to find a peaceful solution, a chunk of that paperwork is actually devoted to water. So water is surely the most important material in the world. But as I told you, water is invisible. And this is not good for us or for water. So why is water so invisible? I think a good explanation for that is that for a long time, at least in the developed world, we've been living in what I call the golden age of water. So what do I mean by the golden age of water? When you're in the golden age, you have three things all at the same time. You have water that is abundant, safe, and cheap. When you have all three of those, you kind of start ignoring water. It doesn't seem so precious or rare anymore. It leads to things like this. If you stayed at a Four Points hotel a few years ago, the little water bottle that was in your room came with a placard on it that said that. It's water. Of course it's free. They were trying to make fun of the hotels that charge you $5 for a bottle of water. But what they're really doing is they're tapping into something primal about our relationship with water. We feel like it should be free. Why would I pay for water? And this mentality of, well, water should be free, there's plenty of it out there and it's safe and whatever, leads us to do things like this. Here in America, we flush almost 6 billion gallons of perfectly fresh drinking water down the toilet every day, literally. This is because you have one pipe of water coming into your house, and that water is drinkable. And you use that same water to flush your toilet or to drink or to wash your clothes or to water your lawn or whatever else you're doing with water. Remember the Romans. They had a better idea. You don't need to use the same quality of water for every purpose. It's time for us to start rethinking that. So how else do we waste water these days? Well, A lot of this is invisible to us under the ground in our water infrastructure, all those water mains. So you don't see them because they're under the streets and sidewalks, but they're in terrible condition. Many of them were built, you know, a century ago, and they're falling apart. So we spend tons of energy and other resources getting water so it's drinkable, cleaning up all the junk that ends up in water, and pumping it out into those water mains, and then one in every six of those gallons of water is just lost to leaks in those pipes underground, because there are so many. Speaking of our infrastructure, tell you how underfunded that problem is. We actually spend about as much buying bottled water in this country as we do maintaining our entire water infrastructure, all the treatment plants, all those water mains, all of it. This is something like a $1 trillion infrastructure need that we have, and we're vastly underspending. How else is water disrespected? This isn't true so much here in the United States, but when you look globally, about 80% of sewage is just discharged untreated back into waterways. You can imagine the problems that that leads to with disease. Hydraulic fracturing impacts our water in many different ways negatively. Agricultural runoff. We put all this fertilizer on our crops with nitrogen and phosphorus and so on, and then either from irrigation or precipitation, a bunch of it gets washed away. Ends up in places like the Gulf of Mexico, you get big algal blooms and dead zones. Huge problem in our waterways today. Heavy metals. This is familiar to anyone in Flint, Michigan these days, or anyone who reads the news, but there are plenty of other ways that heavy metals get into our water. There's a river in Colorado where, you might remember, it was maybe a year or two ago, the EPA accidentally released a bunch of water from a mine that was heavily polluted with heavy metals. We also have lots of pathogens in our water, thanks to, in part, that untreated sewage. Another interesting thing that ends up in our water are these guys, so-called micropollutants. You can take water from your tap and find pretty much all of these things in there, even after it's gone through the treatment plant. The amounts are tiny. They're not relevant necessarily to us, but they're in there. So we are all taking Prozac and birth control in every glass of water. Maybe that's a good thing. So again, these amounts are not high enough to affect us, but they do start affecting ecologies. There have been studies showing some fish species that are affected by those hormones and they're not reproducing properly anymore, for example. So this golden age of water is ending. And this is going to reshape how we all live. It's going to change how our food is raised, how our communities are organized, and in fact, how our entire economy functions. So in the golden age, we had abundant, cheap, and safe. And you're probably going to be able to get 2 out of 3 in most cases. You can have water that's abundant and cheap if you haven't spent any energy cleaning it up, but you're probably not going to want to drink that stuff. You can have water that's abundant and safe if you spend a fortune cleaning it, like the state-of-the-art desalination plant. Or you can have cheap and safe water, but just not enough of it. Think California drought right now. So all of those are going to be situations of water crisis, which certainly is going to be happening a lot in the future. But if you look around the world, water crisis is already happening in many places. So on the next slide, to me, is the scariest statistic I show in any talk that I give. Every time I read it, is amazing to me. Every 90 seconds, a child somewhere dies because of a water-related disease. Every 90 seconds. Think about how many children will be dead by the time we walk out of this room. There's no reason for this to be happening in 2016. Millions of Indian girls and elsewhere, this is true in Africa and many other places too, are trapped by water. And what do I mean by that? They don't have water in their homes. They've got to go get water from some source, a well or otherwise, which on average is well over a mile away from their home. So what that means is all the water you have to use for everything, sanitation, washing your clothes, cooking, you name it, whatever you're going to use water for, every drop needs to be carried on their head from that site over a mile away. That takes so long to do that every day, they don't go to school. They never get to enter the economy and participate like their male siblings. This is another thing that needs to change. So you may have heard the famous quote, all politics is local. I like to say, all water is local. So I told you, we can't move water easily from one region to another. And water needs vary dramatically as you look around the world because of precipitation and population and other things. But even if a water-poor region of the world wanted to buy water from us here, from our Great Lakes, we can't get it to them. You can't get enough water from Lake Michigan to Haiti or somewhere else where they would want water because you just can't move enough. So why don't we have these water pipelines to try and make it more equitable, the distribution of water? So one of the reasons, a very big reason, is the volumes involved, as I described earlier. You'd have to move a ridiculous amount of water, probably not even feasible to move that type of water over really large distances. But there's another problem. So what is water worth? That's kind of actually a hard thing to calculate, but here's some rough numbers for you. It depends what you use it for, first of all. If you're going to use it to grow crops, it's going to be a few tens of dollars per what's called acre foot of water. An acre foot is the amount of water that would cover 1 acre of land 1 foot deep, which is about over 300,000 gallons of water. So it's a lot of water. And all it's worth, agriculturally speaking, is a few tens of dollars. If you're using it in your home, that value might be about $1,000. So we do have pipelines for another liquid, oil, which we move over large distances. Why do we do that? Because that's what an acre foot of oil is worth. That was actually before the recent drop in oil prices. So let's say 250 or 300,000. But you get the picture. The economics just don't make sense to do the same thing with water. So, as I said, we all feel like water should be cheap or maybe even free. But there's this great quote from Ben Franklin. When the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. Oil is substitutable. Water is not.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Dr. Seth Darling, entitled The End of Water as We Know It. Darling is a scientist at Argonne National Lab. His current research blends chemistry, physics, material science, engineering, and nanoscience to create and study materials for energy and water. Come back for the conclusion when TUC Radio returns. As before, many thanks for this recording to Dale Lehman from WZRD Radio in Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.